Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 440 of the Battery Power Podcast. I am your host, Brad Roland, coming to you on a Monday, actually. It's March 18th, and I'm joined by Scott Coleman. Scott, it's Monday instead of Sunday. I was traveling. You were traveling. Fun was had by all. How are you?
Hey, Brad, I am doing great. It is certainly a busy time of year, and as we record this podcast, we are a little bit more than a week away from opening day for the Atlanta Braves, I believe on Tuesday, when most folks listen to this. We are 9 days out from opening day. So very exciting. Baseball is on the horizon. And there was some pretty significant news, actually, on a Monday, which you don't always get.
Yeah. In fact, we were going to do an episode no matter what in this range, Monday, Tuesday-ish. And then I had some ideas, some mailbag questions and things, and that basically we had to throw out the rundown in a not a bad way. I wasn't expecting necessarily for the Braves to essentially set their roster as of Monday, March 18th. Now, things could change. I have to say that out loud. They could sign people. It is what it is. But as far as the internal roster decisions, oftentimes teams will wait until the very last minute. And it feels like the Braves kind of set their roster today, Scott, at least unofficially, as of Monday, March 18th.
Right. There is no contractual binding when a player gets sent down to minor league camp that they could not be on the opening day roster. But it generally means that they are not going to break the regular season with the team. And I believe there are 28 players on the major league roster or on the big league roster at this point, and two of them are set for the 60-day injured list, a couple of relievers. So by all accounts, there is a world, I guess, where the Braves could sign a player if he gets cut by another team or maybe sign a free agent. But at this point, it seems like the Braves have their 26 and they're going to be ready to go more than a week ahead of time, which is pretty rare.
Yeah, I wanted to always get the contingencies out of the way early because it is so unusual. But even on the record today, you know, all the reporters are still in Florida talking to Brian Snitker. Everyone's pretty open about the fact that this is their 26 at this moment. And, you know, not a bad thing for content purposes, but here we are. So we'll go through a little bit of what sort of transpired. We will talk about Adam Duvall, who you and I kind of called the Adam Duvall signing a week ago. But I think the number one thing as far as today was concerned is that it isn't a surprise, but the Braves chose to send Bryce Elder and Waskari Noah down to Gwinnett, essentially ending the battle for the fifth starter job and giving it to Reynaldo Lopez. Snitker then confirmed that, basically, on the record. I'm gonna give the quote that Brian gave to the media today. Quote, "It's all a part about having rotation depth. We used 13 starters last year. In normal years, we've used 11. It's just a way to keep everybody in play." He also said the Braves will, quote, "just use common sense as we navigate the whole 7 months." So basically, you and I talked about this last week on the show on our rotation preview. Somewhat of the idea is, even if it was close at all, they would probably just roll with Lopez because Elder has minor league options and they have Lopez stretched out. They wanted to give him a chance. And in the end, that is what they're going to do.
It really just provides flexibility for the Braves. And we've talked at length over the last couple of weeks about the trade-offs of utilizing Bryce Elder in the rotation versus using Reynaldo Lopez. And I think as we kind of talked ourselves into, just made a lot of sense to have Reynaldo start the season in the rotation and for the Braves to really get an idea of what they have. I think we know pretty comfortably at this point that Reynaldo Lopez is a good to great reliever, but we don't necessarily know what he's going to be as a starter every 5 days. And if you're going to stretch him out and use him in that rotation role, it makes a lot of sense to do it now. He's built up in the spring, and now he's going to have a chance to establish himself as a starter. And I think in a perfect world, he is so good and his body cooperates and holds up to where he's in the rotation for the better part of the season. But if you're a month or two into this and it's just not working out super well, you can very easily shift Lopez to the bullpen and then call upon Bryce Elder or AJ Smith-Shawver or one of those Gwinnett starters without having to move too many cards around.
Yeah, basically that is the less sexy version. You know, there's one sort of story here that you could tell about essentially the Braves believing that Reynaldo Lopez is better than Bryce Elder. And they probably do, to be honest. But that's just one way of framing it. The other way is just what you said, sort of what Snit said, is that Elder could go down. Lopez was never going to go down. He was either going to be in rotation or in the bullpen. And they, I don't know if they promised him rotation potential when they signed him, but from the moment that they signed him, they were messaging that he might start and they were going to stretch him out and give him a chance to kind of do that. And yeah, if it goes poorly, there is a recourse for this. They could put Ronaldo in the bullpen where they trust him to be good. And he's been there. He's been very good the last couple of years in that role. They have Elder, they have Smith Shaver, et cetera, and even just kind of said the quiet part out loud, like they're going to need more than five, six, seven starters along the way. And their first week, first 2 weeks, they have their five, and then we're going to go from there. But no surprise at all. Honestly, we kind of called this a week ago, and it was common sense in some ways.
This was almost the opposite of last year's spring training battle for shortstop, where we were pretty convinced that it was going to be Vaughn Grissom, and then Braden Shumake had a moment in the sun, and then the Braves were like, just kidding, it's actually Orlando Arcia. This move with Ronaldo Lopez was, I think, telegraphed pretty clearly for some time now, really since the beginning of spring training. And, you know, for Bryce Elder, it is a bummer. I'm sure no matter what he might say publicly, I'm sure he's bummed. He had a really nice moment in the first half last season as an all-star, but that fell apart. Jeez, fell apart pretty quickly. And, you know, hopefully now he's able to get down in Gwinnett and pitch every fifth day. And as we all kind of suspect, at some point, he will be back in Atlanta and hopefully being more of the first half Bryce Elder than the second half.
Yeah, that's a good place to kind of leave that for now. If you want more in the rotation, we did discuss it last week for an hour plus on the show. We'll save Duvall for a second and go to the rest of the battles. By the way, Orlando Arcia got hit in the wrist slash hand with a fastball on Sunday. Both the X-ray and the MRI were negative, and all the media guys are saying he's doing better as of today. So hopefully they avoided damage there. One of the contingency plans of this podcast was to be like kind of on Arcia watch today. And fortunately for the Braves, no damage, it appears, at least that will keep him out for a long time.
Yeah, definitely a moment to exhale. Anytime you get a guy hit in the wrist or the hand, you really do have to hold your breath. And he, of course, I believe broke a bone or had something going on. He got hit with a pitch last year as well and missed a couple of weeks, although he was able to make a pretty fast recovery and really didn't miss a whole bunch. So good news to be sure. If there's one position on this roster and in this lineup that the Braves really don't have a great backup option for, it would be shortstop. It's a tough position to play, and they just don't really have any great options internally should Orlando go down for any period of time. So definitely a good thing that there was nothing seriously wrong. I'm guessing the Braves will have Arcia rest a couple of days, hopefully get him back out there for the weekend and just kind of get him going again before the season begins in about a week and a half.
Yeah, so no damage there. Other roster things, the Braves kind of set their bench, as we talked about before, with the entire roster kind of being set. They sent David Fletcher, Luke Williams, and Eli White to minor league camp. That essentially announced that Forrest Wall is going to be the 26th man, essentially, because Luis Guillorme was always going to be in line for that backup infielder job, and they kind of could go either way on the last spot. Forrest Wall, of course, is a guy who excels in running the bases and playing some defense, not the greatest hitter in the world. And the Braves, I don't know if it's to their credit or what, but they have not really used that last spot for a prominent way. Famously last year, Charlie Culberson was in that spot without playing at all for like a long time. They just kind of don't use that spot for the most part, but Forrest Wall has some utility there, and they've gone in that direction, leaving guys like Fletcher, Williams, and White on the outside looking in for now.
Well, I'm just happy to see Forrest Wall in that role.
Yeah,
I think of all of the outfield options, he probably brings the most intrigue because, as you mentioned, he is very fast. He has real speed. He was on the postseason roster for the Braves a year ago. And as you outlined, unless there's probably multiple injuries at this point, I mean, it would really take two injuries for Forrest Wall to begin playing every day in the outfield now that Adam Duvall is in the fold. You know, he's very likely going to sit the bench. I would imagine the most we're going to see him is in the ninth inning. If it's a tie game and Sean Murphy leads off the ninth with a walk, guess what? It is Forrest Wall time. He will come in, pinch run, hopefully steal second base, maybe steal third base. He did that a couple of times last year and try to steal away a run and a win in a close game late. So I guess there is a world where the Braves go out and add somebody over the next week or so, but I just don't get that vibe. I think Forrest Wall is perfectly fine in that 26th man role. And he does have some skills that I'm sure at some point this season, the Braves will look to call upon.
Yeah. And honestly, to your point about them not finding anybody else, they kind of did the Forrest Wall media tour today. They almost officially announced him in a way that you have not seen. And it's a feel good story, which is why it's a cool thing. I'm sure they want to get that story out there that he is going to be making the team and breaking camp with them. I doubt they would have done that if they were planning on doing something else, if that makes sense. Like they went a little bit over what you would normally expect. again, because it's a feel-good, great thing for a guy who's had a very winding road to get here. But they would have been a little bit quieter, I'd imagine, if they were kind of actively looking for a replacement for him.
Yeah, it would be a tough look, to be sure. Not that, as you just said, a media tour guarantees anything in Penn.
But it does not. But still,
of course,
logistically, I mean, logistics-wise, like, you don't do that if there's any doubt, I don't think. But maybe not.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. And, you know, I'm a sucker for guys like Forrest Wall. He is 28 years old, made his major league debut last fall at age 27. And I mean, those stories just write themselves, just incredible perseverance and to stick around in the minor leagues, making very little money and, you know, taking the team buses from small town to small town for the better part of a decade is just awesome. So hopefully he's able to stick around, collect that nice paycheck, even if he's not doing a whole bunch. He, as you said a minute ago, even if he is in the Charlie Culberson role of being a good teammate and being available if needed, but probably not called upon a whole lot. You know, there's certainly worse players and stories to have as your 26th man. And I'm sure he is pretty giddy right now with the idea of being on the roster for opening day.
Yeah, it's a very, very cool thing to sort of follow. And look, he actually has a skill set that makes some sense in that role. Like, he's not going to probably help you as a pinch hitter, but if you want a speed guy who can play a little bit of defense, he can play center for you on a night where you want to give Harris a day off or whatever, they can kind of do that. And it does kind of make some logical sense. The bullpen is also seemingly finalized at this point. No big surprises here, but they're going to go with Matzik, Dylan Lee, and Jackson Stevens as the guys that were kind of in somewhat of a mystery coming into the last couple of weeks. Stevens is sort of being the long man, you would imagine. Matzik has been, you know, kind of looked okay by all accounts. Dylan Lee, we like a lot on this podcast. This is the spot where it's almost probably the easiest to pick someone up in the next couple of weeks if they wanted to, but I think they're pretty comfortable with this. And honestly, if Jackson Stevens is your last guy in the bullpen, you're doing fine.
Yeah, I like Jackson Stevens. Maybe, I mean, he just seems like a likable dude. He's just kind of big and burly and goes out there and, man, he'll take the ball and he'll throw multiple innings if you need him to. I thought that was a real something he did quite well a couple of years ago when he was in that role. And, you know, I think for me, just having a healthy Tyler Matzik and a healthy Dylan Lee, and knock on wood that their health cooperates. But we know, I think, that if these two guys are healthy, if Matzik's elbow and Lee's shoulder are holding up, I'm pretty confident they're going to be effective in their role. And the Braves are going to have some real weapons from the left side with Matzik and Lee, Aaron Bummer, and of course, AJ Minter. So really just a deep group. We talked about the bullpen at length a couple of weeks ago on that preview podcast. Good to have them back, especially Matzik. We know what that man has meant to this organization. He is somebody, you talk about a great story in Forrest Wall. There are few players in the course of recent baseball memory who have greater stories than Tyler Matzik. It'll be great to have him out there, and let's hope his elbow cooperates and he's able to get back into a high leverage spot.
Yeah, definitely let's hope about that. And, you know, we already knew that there were going to be some absolute locks for the bullpen. And there were three spots that were at least tangentially open, and they are no longer open at this point. Again, Matzik, Dylan Lee, and Jackson Stevens will fill them. And the last bit of roster news is a few days old now, but because you and I kind of, I don't know if we spoke into existence or what happened there, but Adam Duvall is back. 1 year, $3 million. It's been covered by Chris and Steven, and then also by Sean when the news actually broke. It was cheaper than expected. I kind of thought that if they did this, it was going to cost them more than this. But at the same time, Duvall was also available in mid-March. And at some point, the clock is ticking. You kind of have to sign somewhere and make some money for yourself and your family. And Duvall is well-liked around here. The only bit of intrigue beyond just like signing him and what your reaction is to that, and I want to get to that for sure, is the Braves were pretty immediately announcing effectively that he's going to platoon with Jerry Kelnick. Like, we thought that they could bring him in, number one. And also, if they did, there was the potential to either have him sort of in a backup role at a bunch of different places, you know, DH, corner outfield, maybe a little bit of center if they had to, but they went out and just didn't even hide from it. They were like, all right, he's going to platoon with Jerry Kelnick. And that isn't a stunning development, given that Kelnick has had a rough spring, to say the least. But if you told me 3 months ago, when the Braves were very, very confidently on the record saying Kelnick was going to be their everyday left fielder, it's a bit of a change from that.
There's a couple of interesting layers to this signing. I guess for Duvall himself, longtime listeners know that Brad and I are big fans of Adam Duvall, and I think a lot of Braves fans are too. Is he a perfect player? No, but there's a reason that he was available for a year and $3 million. I would imagine that Duvall had a couple of options. I don't have any sourcing on this, but I would guess he could have gone a few places, but he is a veteran. He's already made very real money throughout his career. And to have a chance to be in a platoon role and make $3 million on a World Series frontrunner in a place that he has a lot of familiarity, I think that's pretty appealing. And I think the Braves started out, and we'll see what the breakdown is with Jared Kelnick. That's really the thing I think we should talk about the most here. I think the Braves have a lot of reason and incentive to give Jared Kelnick an opportunity to be successful just about every day. But to have an in-house insurance policy as good as Adam Duvall is really a good thing to have, especially in the middle of March. I still think that Kelnick goes out there and plays basically every day against right-handed pitching, which is going to be a large majority of the time. But it has not been a great spring for Kelnick. I don't want to overblow 42 plate appearances in the spring and make any conclusions from that. But it is good to know that you have Duvall on the bench as a option against left-handed pitching. It also gives you insurance in case Marcelo Zuna would either get hurt or reverse to his old ways. You know that Duvall could be a designated hitter. And he's versatile enough that he could also probably play center field still. He could play right field if Acuna needs a day or two. So really just a nice addition late in the spring. Frankly, teams don't generally add players like Adam Duvall this late in the spring training calendar. It's really nice to have Adam back, and it'll be good to have him as that fourth outfielder in the mix.
Yeah, he's very overqualified for the role, but not in a way that is like ridiculous. That was kind of what we talked about even on last few shows when we were kind of half joking, but also not half joking about it. He just makes a lot of sense. The only thing that I would say, and something actually our friend Stephen Tolbert pointed out behind the scenes a lot as well, Duvall is not exactly the perfect platoon partner in some ways. Like, he's not really a lefty masher. He kind of never has been. He's good enough at hitting lefties. A 109 WRC plus last 2 years against lefties. So, like, he's fine against them, but he's never been a huge platoon split guy. Kelnick is a platoon split guy so far. So, you know, you're adding someone who's obviously better against lefties on paper than Jared Kelnick, which is kind of all the requirement is. And again, having Duvall around to be, you know, a decent defender, a backup DH option, et cetera, all that stuff makes sense no matter what. But just, I want to at least throw that out there. Like, he's actually not what you would think, and that he's not really like a guy who makes his bones mashing lefties. So that's just an area to watch. I don't think it matters necessarily. It's still functionally the same setup, but it's not like you have a guy that's coming in here just like, only it does one thing well, and it's raking against lefties.
Yeah, he's a well-rounded player. And looking at his numbers last season with the Red Sox, he was pretty darn good. And he worked
He's so streaky, man. It's so funny. Like, yeah, not to cut you, but like, that's the thing. I'm sure we have some new Braves fans, maybe, or younger people. Adam Duvall's entire bit is that he's incredibly streaky. Like, when he's bad, it's real bad. But then when he's good, it's real good. So it's just be along for the ride. You kind of have to set it and forget it. Like, you can't just ride with Adam Duvall every single day because it's going to be a roller coaster.
He had an unbelievable stretch. I want to say it was in April and May where he was genuinely like the best hitter on the planet. And then he had an equally bad stretch that followed. But again, there's a reason that he's a fourth outfielder type, and he didn't have half of the leagues giving him half the teams in the league offering five-year deals. But on the whole, he had about 350 plate appearances last season with the Red Sox, 21 home runs, struck out a bit. That is something he will always do. He's never really been an on-base percentage guy, but a .531 slugging percentage, hit about .250 and was worth almost two WAR in 60% of a season. There's definitely some value here. Again, just a really kind of a luxury to have him on the bench. We'll see what his role is going forward. I know that folks are maybe a little down on Kelnick. I'm not going to sit here and lie and say, well, actually, it's a good thing that he's only hitting 086 in the spring or whatever Kelnick is hitting. But I also just think that it's natural to have all eyes on the new guy. And it's funny enough, if Jared Kelnick goes out there and has five hits on opening weekend, people are going to forget about the spring because there's just no correlation between having a good spring and having a strong season. But overall, man, for the Braves to have now Duvall and Kelnick available for left field, it's a good spot to be in. And I hope folks just aren't overreacting too much to a slow start here from Kelnick.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with that. And also, look, on the other side, if you want to be pessimistic, I guess there is a world where Kelnick is so bad for a while that you kind of have to pull the plug for a little bit and reset him. He's got options left. You could just plug Duvall in every day in left field and he'd be fine. So there's a little bit of depth there as well. I'm on your side about the Kelnick struggles. on the one hand, like, he hasn't been that good in the majors. So, like, it's more of a talent bet. We talked about that a lot when they traded for him. They're not trading for this ready-made guy. They're looking for upside, team control, talent, a former, you know, top prospect. So they've also been pretty open about how they're kind of, I don't want to say tinkering with him, but they're certainly working on some stuff with Jared Kelnick. And basically everyone's doing that in the spring, but especially for a guy who hasn't quite established himself yet, I think that his numbers in the spring mean even less to me than a normal guy, because he's obviously, they're trying some stuff for a new guy.
Yeah, have a little patience. And I know all eyes will be on Kelnick just because he is kind of the one unknown in this otherwise awesome lineup.
Yeah, that's also going to be unfortunate for him, because, like, Arcia is not unknown. We kind of know what he is. But aside from Arcia, it's a bunch of stars. So it's kind of a tough spot if you're a new guy. Like, hey, Jared, you got to be as good as Michael Harris. You know, obviously he's not going to be as good as Michael Harris, but it's one of those things where a lot of pressure for a guy. And I think he's actually, I read a story, I can't remember who wrote this story, but he kind of admitted, like, you know, he had some self-doubt when he got traded. Like, I'm sure there's a lot of, like, mental hurdles that a guy like that has to go through when they've been a top prospect, have failed / struggled, gotten traded. You may feel like your old team didn't want you, that kind of stuff. Like, that could be a struggle. So it's going to be interesting to see how he bounces back.
Yeah, I think we just have to hope and let him settle in. He's going to be at the bottom of the lineup. As we talked about the day they traded for him and really throughout the winter, the Braves don't need Jared Kelnick to be a superstar.
Nope.
They just don't. I mean, they were perfectly fine. They were historic in some ways with Eddie Rosario being very average in left field last season. And while it's fair to hope that Kelnick unlocks something and becomes a really good young player to add to the Braves' core, he won't necessarily need to come in and set the world on fire in order to be viewed as a successful season. So let's hope that it's just a blip on the radar. As you said, I'm sure the Braves are adjusting a few things. And anytime you start changing a swing, it can take some time to get comfortable and to get your timing down. As we know, it is just such a game of micro adjustments, and it's so difficult to make changes on the fly. But overall, I still think the Braves are in a good spot with left field, especially given the 1-7 that's going to be ahead of him in the lineup most nights.
All right, Scott, let us pivot to a couple of mailbag questions that we got, and they're actually kind of on the same topic, so I combined them together. One of them is from Hunter, who says, which team is the biggest threat to the Braves winning a 7th straight NL East title, and then who would be next on that list? And then the follow-up to that question is from Seth, who says, how much has to go wrong for the Braves not to win the division? So I'll preface this by saying we're going to have our final predictions on another podcast between now and opening day. So we won't give our entire spiel here, but I thought it was interesting. We sort of have not talked about the NL East a ton, partially because the Braves are such big favorites, but they are big favorites. That's notable, but nothing's a given in baseball. Baseball is weird. And I guess two questions for you, Scott: how much has to go wrong? And then also, who's number two in this division?
It's a good question. I think for my money, the Phillies are pretty clearly the biggest threat to the Braves here. For obvious reasons. I mean, they have arguably the best starting rotation in the majors. And while their lineup is getting older, which I think is something that kind of goes overlooked sometimes, the lineup is still really pretty darn good. And for my money, the Marlins last year, I just never bought it. I know they snuck into the postseason. They were playing well above their heads for a long chunk. And then for the Mets, everything went wrong for the Mets last season. I actually did the Mets write-up in the preview on batterypower.com that should be up any day now. Now, the Mets last season had a lot of things go wrong. They, of course, waved the white flag at the trade deadline and got rid of Scherzer and Verlander and a few others. But there's still quite a bit of talent in that lineup, and they need Kodai Senga healthy. He got hurt. He was their by far and away their best starting pitcher. He should be back probably in May. I do think the Mets have, like, sneaky wild card 3 potential if everything goes right and they get some bounce back seasons. I'm really not a believer in the Marlins. And then the Nationals, while they are on the right path to rebuilding, they are still, you know, leaps and bounds behind the Braves and even the Phillies. So to answer the question, it's the Phillies for me as the biggest threat. But I really do think that, I mean, man, there would have to be some really bad things happen to the Braves for them not to win the division again.
Yeah, I think we agree. Philly is the very clear number two. We definitely agree on that. I think that it will be a literal shock to me if someone other than the Braves or Phillies wins the National League East. I think the Braves are a big favorite to win the division, as the projection models, as the betting markets all say. I could at least see a world where Philly wins 98 games, and that is enough. Does that make sense? I can't imagine the Mets or the Marlins winning enough games to where the Braves would have to just be such an underwhelming disappointment. Like, I mean, how much? I don't want to jinx it too much, but can you see the Braves winning like 85 games? I have a hard time seeing that. I really do.
It would require, man, I don't even want to speak it into existence.
I know. I mean,
it would require, I'll say it like this. It would require the two best pitchers in the starting rotation to get hurt and miss basically the entire year, and probably have an injury or two in the lineup. So the injuries are the one thing you could never count on, right? It's impossible to predict, but it would require, I think, just the rotation getting completely destroyed by injuries.
Yeah. So that is what I would say in general, is that if the Braves land somewhere within what I view as a reasonable range of outcomes, and I'm probably going to give you a wider range than most people would, because I have just, that's the way my brain works. Like, I could see the Braves, like, a lot goes wrong and they win 92 games instead of 103. You know what I mean? And I think if that happened, Philly could beat them in the division. That is sure. A plausible outcome to me.
Yes. Yeah.
I think it would take a lot for the Braves to fall behind the Mets and the Marlins. And I could be wrong about that, but there we are. By the way, just for some numbers real quickly on this, Fangraph projects the Braves to win the East by 13 games. That is an outrageous projection. and I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that you do not often see that kind of break in a division. They have 88.5% division winning odds at Fangraphs. The next best team in the league on that metric is 76%, and that's the Dodgers. No one in the American League has more than 63% to win their division. So the Braves are by far the biggest divisional favorite in all of baseball. By the way, speaking of this, I'm not sure if you've seen this right now. As we're recording this podcast, the Giants just signed Blake Snell.
Yeah, finally, the free agent dam has broken on March 18th. The NL West is going to be crazy this year.
So that's going to impact the Dodgers' division odds. Is why I'm saying that now, because I think they're probably a little bit. Not, by the way, they're still going to be favored to win the division. But if you just add Blake Snell and the Giants, that doesn't help the Dodgers. That's for sure.
Yeah, in some ways, the Giants, not to become a San Francisco Giants podcast, but the Giants have really benefited from how Scott Boras kind of mismanaged this winter, because they added Matt Chapman. Now they add the reigning Cy Young winner and Blake Snell. I mean, they've really added. I mean, teams generally don't add a Matt Chapman and a Blake Snell to the roster in the middle of March. To get back on the East, I agree entirely. There is a world where the Phillies could overtake the Braves. 2 years ago, the Phillies won 87 games, and last season, the Phillies won 90. And basically nothing has changed from the roster from last year. They brought back Aaron Nola, and they tinkered with a few minor things, but nothing else has significantly changed. So they would be asking a roster that's pretty old to make another jump, and I suppose it's possible, but the Mets and the Marlins, they have a less than 1% chance of winning the division, I think it's fair to say. The Mets just don't have a ton of pitching. The Marlins,
they're also kind of punting. Like, we don't have to do a whole Mets thing, but like, the Mets are almost in this gap year, and they've almost admitted it, where they're not spending the way they were maybe going to spend because of the way last year went. You remember last year at the end of pre-deadline, they kind of sold. I mean, they were so underwhelming that they ended up selling at the deadline, which was like, that's mind blowing in itself after they had gone all in to kind of catch the Braves, and they never did it. But they're kind of in this world where they're in between big Steve Cohen pushes, I think, for the Mets this year.
Yeah.
So that's part of why they're underwhelming. And you and I agree on the Marlins. The Marlins beating the Mets last year by 9 games in the standings is actually insane.
That happened.
Go Marlins. No, I think we're in agreement on the list, but maybe we'll have an official prediction next week. But I think we are generally in lockstep on the Braves being big favorites, and Philly being very, very clearly the team that is most likely to challenge the Braves in the National League East. Scott, that is probably all we have on baseball today. We're like 30 minutes in. Normally we would keep going, but we've pledged something to our listeners. So unless you have more baseball takes to get off, feel free if you'd like to. I'll give you the opportunity.
I was just going to say the National League race is going to be a lot of fun this year.
It is.
Very clearly, for my money, the Braves and Dodgers are 1A and 1B. We could probably argue for 30 minutes and you know, have a whole conversation about that. But you know, after them, there's just a really big glut of teams where if things go right, it could be a really good year. And there's also some real pitfalls in some of these rosters here that are not great, 1 through 26. So it should be a fun race across the league. The National League Central has, I think, probably three teams that are serious contenders, maybe four. The NL West, as we just talked about, I mean, the Padres just added Dylan Cease, who was a once upon a time Braves trade target. The Giants we talked about, the Diamondbacks are coming off their run. The Dodgers are loaded. The Rockies are existing. I mean, the Rockies might literally lose 115 games this year, which is just going to be sad to watch. But it's going to be a fun National League, and let's hope the Braves have a seventh straight division tie. Man, time flies. That's crazy to think they're already going to pursue a seventh pennant this upcoming year. Feels like just yesterday we were talking about coming out of the rebuild and trying to build a winner every single year. It's just been a lot of fun.
Yeah, when we launched the podcast, the Braves were pretty bad. So that feels like it was a long time ago, because it was a long time ago in some respects. Well, Scott, we do this once a year, literally, where we actually talk about something that's not—it's not about baseball. So I'm going to give everybody the warning right now: if you don't care about college basketball and the NCAA tournament, this is the end of baseball talk on this podcast. Don't feel like you're going to hang around and miss something. I promise you, no more baseball stuff on this podcast. And by popular demand, we'll do like 10 minutes on basketball. Are you ready, Scott?
I am ready. This might be, other than a playoff preview and recap after wins, this might be my favorite 15 minutes we do on the podcast all year, Brad. So let's get going.
And at least five people have asked us for this, at least. I think more than that, but at least five that I can think of.
Shout out. A couple people have tweeted over the week. Shout out to you all. Brad and I are big basketball, college basketball fans. The NCAA tournament, a couple of days away. And again, there will be no more baseball talk after this point. So if you don't like the college basketball and the NCAA tournament, thank you for tuning in.
Yes.
Thank you much. We'll see you next time at some point. But let's dig on into this tournament.
Okay, so this will not be the most deep dive that you'll hear on the basketball tournament. You can find that elsewhere. But an interesting field. I'll ask a broad question first, Scott, because I've not talked to you since the bracket actually was revealed on Sunday. Were you as mad about the seeding as everybody else was?
Not mad, but I think surprised was probably the word to describe it.
I guess your team got seeded appropriately, so that was fine. So
yeah, it was all over the place. You know, like Gonzaga was like firmly in the 7-8-9 mix, and they were a 5 seed, and like nobody had Virginia making it, and they're in, and just across the board, some odd seeding. Although it was like historically an all time weird conference tournament week, and an all time. I mean, the bubble was really strong this year too, which was interesting. So it was not an easy task for the selection committee. But yes, the bracket was a little weird.
Yeah, FAU is 8 seed. I like them a lot. They did not deserve to be an 8 seed. The committee chairman saying New Mexico was going to be left out if they didn't win the Mountain West was outrageous. They won the Mountain West. It didn't actually matter, but that was a wild one. They should have been like a 9 seed. Anyway, I can go all day, but I won't do this. Just for everybody knows, if somebody don't know this, Scott is an Arizona alum / Arizona fan. So when I say his team, he's an Arizona guy. Everybody should know that.
I am ready to be broken once again, Brad. It has been 23 long years since the last Final Four and national championship game appearance for the Wildcats, and about 27 years since the last national title. So in some ways, I am hoping the universes collide. The Michigan Wolverines, your team, won their national title in football.
That's
maybe
right.
It's Arizona's time. I say that as if I'm not going to have my dreams crushed in like 96 hours or something like that. But let's hope that planets align and something special happens this March.
And the Final Four is in Glendale, Arizona, which isn't like down the street from you, but it's in the same state. It's not far.
Yeah. It's the Final Four. I would highly, if folks ever have an opportunity to go to the Final Four, I would recommend it. They do a great job putting on the event. It's not just the two basketball games. There's so many things happening outside the stadium and during the week. So it really is a cool, just spectacle of an event. I would assume it's coming probably to Atlanta sometime soon. Maybe. I don't know.
It was supposed to be in Atlanta in 2020. They pledged to give Atlanta a Final Four back because they lost that one because the whole tournament went away. And to this point, they have not rescheduled it. So hopefully that will happen at some point. But they got robbed of one as of now, which I'm bothered by. Scott, I'm not enjoying that. Alas.
Well, fly on out. If any listeners, if your favorite team makes the Final Four, come on out. Everybody can stay in my one guest bedroom. and we'll just pile in there, watch some Braves baseball, and then get a van and go up to Phoenix. It'll be a grand old.
Yeah, you could stay 2 hours away at Scott's house. I'll actually be in Glendale, but you can't stay with me. My apologies. In my tiny hotel room, I'll probably
you could fit. You could fit some people in that hotel room, Brad.
Yeah, my media hotel will probably be the lap of luxury. But anyway, all right, Scott. Let's talk about some basketball. The East region, UConn is the big favorite, of course. They're number one overall seed. They won it last year. I followed them last year, not on purpose, but I was at the regional last year and the Final Four, and they looked incredible. Different team, of course, this time around, because college basketball, it all changes year to year these days, but they're still really good again. And they kind of got an unfavorable draw for number one overall seed. Iowa State, Illinois, and Auburn are the 2, 3, and 4 in that region, all of whom rank very highly, especially Iowa State and Auburn in the predicted metrics like KenPom, Bart Torvik, etc. If you're a nerd, you'll know what that means. Also, they have FAU. They have Washington State, Arizona rival Washington State. They have San Diego State, a reigning Final Four team too. So a tough draw for UConn, even though they are, by all counts, at least by most people's accounts, the best team in the field.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no favors done to the number one overall seed and the reigning champions. Auburn is, I mean, they look tremendous with their run they just went on in the SEC tournament. Iowa State just made Houston look worse than they have looked basically at any point in like 4 years in the Big 12 championship. San Diego State plays a brutal style of basketball where they will just bleed the clock out. And if you miss your one shot, they rebound it and they just walk down the floor and kill 25 seconds off the clock. And that's why they were able to make their run last year. Illinois can really score it. I mean, just across the board, this is not an easy draw for UConn at all. I still think they probably get through it because they are such a wagon and just so relentless for 40 minutes. But every now and then you look at a team and you're like, yeah, they're going to walk to the Final Four. I don't think that's the case for UConn as good as they are.
Yeah, I was ready to pick UConn to win their region before the bracket came out. And I think as a pivot, kind of against, you know, I'm in some bigger bracket pools, stuff like that. I think I'm going to go against UConn. And not because I don't like UConn. I think it's because of the region being very difficult. Iowa State's really good. Illinois is dangerous. And Auburn is really kind of scary, I think, this year. Plus, like, some pretty decent down ballot or so, you know, BYU is really good. They can score on anybody, for instance. Wazoo plays ugly basketball. They can beat you. So does San Diego State. So that's a scary one. We'll come back to it in a second. But that's an interesting region for sure. The region that your team is in, Scott, is the West. UNC is the number one seed, but they are pretty clearly the fourth number one seed. And when you're the two seed, as your team is, in the bracket that has the worst number one seed, that's not a bad place to be just on its own.
Well, and especially if it's, you know, North Carolina potentially having to travel to Los Angeles in a, you know, possible Elite Eight and Sweet 16 versus Arizona having to travel to Los Angeles. That's an hour flight for the Wildcats, but of course, cross country for UNC.
At least I will say this, UNC has a lot of fans and they have a lot of money. So I think that if Arizona were to play anybody but UNC in that game, it's going to be an Arizona home game. I think UNC would be a little bit more competitive in the fan environment than everybody else would be. But like, you know, Baylor, Alabama, St. Mary's, Clemson, Dayton, Michigan State, Mississippi State, I think that Arizona fans will be flooding to LA if they get there.
Yeah, big alumni base, of course, just not that far away from campus. You know, overall for both Arizona and of course UNC, I'm sure we have a lot of Tar Heel listeners. You know, this region to me was probably the weakest of the four. You know, the Midwest is not super stacked either, but you know, you look at teams, Baylor is solid. Though defensively, they've had some real issues. Alabama is a roller coaster ride every time they go on the court with their high octane offense, but just the defense is so bad sometimes. And then St. Mary's is a really good team. I'm sure a lot of folks on the East Coast have not gotten to see a ton of St. Mary's. They're a very good team, a very disciplined team, but they just kind of lack the true talent and upside, I think, that you need in order to win 4, 5, or 6 games in March. So there's just not a ton of high-end talent in this region. And, you know, as an Arizona fan, I'm all for it. I'll take it. Sometimes it's not necessarily how good your team is or how you're playing that day, but just the luck of the draw and who ends up in your path.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I don't love anybody in that region. I think UNC's done a good job this year bouncing back after the year from hell last year for UNC when nothing went right all year long. How about the Caleb Love Bowl potentially if that happens? Can we talk about that for a second?
That would be pretty wild for Caleb Love, North Carolina legend, to face off with his old team for a spot in the Final Four. Love has been tremendous. I know he exited from UNC and there was some behind the scenes stuff that was reported or rumored or whatever, but he's been great for Arizona this year. Brad, I did want to throw out the upset pick of this region. And actually in the first round, it's not even technically an upset, which is funny. But New Mexico, for folks who maybe haven't seen a lot of New Mexico basketball this year, New Mexico is very, very good, and I actually think they're going to make the Sweet 16. They have great guard play. They have a big guy who protects the rim. So I think they beat Clemson, and then I think they have the horses to stick with Baylor's guards. And if I had to pick a double-digit seed to make the Sweet 16, I would take New Mexico.
I kind of like it because I couldn't believe that they weren't already sounding in the field. The committee chairman noted on the record that they were going to be left out if they didn't win the Mountain West, and they did win the Mountain West in impressive fashion, but that's a good team. So I'm on board with that. I think Clemson should be not very happy that they have to play New Mexico in the first round. That was a unfriendly seating for all involved. And I always say this, but the team that gets screwed by a miss seating is the team that is supposed to play you more so than the team that is actually being misseeded, if that makes sense. Like if you're seed and you're playing an 11 seed, that should be an 8 seed. That's actually screwing the 6 seed more than anything else.
Yeah. I mean, in the eyes of like Ken Pom and Bart Torvik, New Mexico is a higher rated team than Clemson. And I know that the computer models are not perfect and that's why you play the games. But yes, if you're a Clemson fan, that is a tough, tough draw after a really nice season for Clemson. That's a tough draw as a 6-11.
Yeah, Brad Brunell has been fired like 10 times, and he won't be fired, but he did a good job this year at Clemson. Okay, let's go to the South. This is Houston's region as the number one seed. Marquette is the number two seed, and they have some injury concerns with their best player, Tyler Colick, All-American level guard who's been banged up in recent days. But then you have a bunch of big name teams, Kentucky, Duke, Wisconsin. Nebraska is actually good this year, which is strange to say out loud. Florida lost their center. I hope people didn't see the actual replay of that. I don't know if you saw it, Scott. That was a brutal-looking injury to Florida's starting center over the weekend. And then Texas Tech's also in this region. I'll say this, Scott. I unabashedly love Houston. And they play hideous basketball to other people. I love Houston. Love them.
Yeah, I do too. I was never a believer in Houston as of a couple of years ago. And then they just bullied Arizona off the court in the Sweet 16. And it was like, wow, these dudes can ball. This is an interesting region for me. I think both Marquette and Kentucky, if they hit their ceiling, especially Kentucky, have the ability and potential to go to the Final Four and maybe even beyond. But you just said Marquette with Tyler Colick being iffy. I think he's going to play. I don't know if I missed something, but
yeah, I think he's going to play, but he did not play in the Big East, which was notable. So
yeah. And then Kentucky, they have as much talent as anybody in college basketball, but it just has been a bumpy ride, really, for the whole way. They've had some injuries. They've had some issues on defense. But, you know, you're telling me that Kentucky gets hot for four games? I mean, they're one of the few teams here, I think, who could really knock off Houston in a 40-minute game.
Yeah. No, and the thing about Houston is they're similar, not exactly the same thing, but that Virginia team that ended up winning the championship with DeAndre Hunter, Ty Jerome, et cetera, they were awesome, and of course they proved to be awesome in the end. But they also play a style, they played slower than Houston does, but it was a lower scoring defense first style. And in a low possession game, it's easier to get beat in some ways. So Houston has always kind of been susceptible to that potentially. Of course, Virginia managed to string it together for six games once in 2019 in Minneapolis. But Houston, I love them, but it could be interesting if they had the wrong night. Cause like we saw against Iowa State, like if they don't make shots, they could be beat, even though they have the best teams in the country by the stats.
Yeah. And you know what? There's always seemingly a region where things get really interesting with the four and the five seeds. I think Duke and Wisconsin win, but those are by no means guarantees. I mean, Vermont is seemingly in the tournament every single year. And Wisconsin has had just a very up and down Jekyll and Hyde season. They were really bad, and then they just had a nice run in the Big Ten. But they are certainly mortal. It seems like every year there's a 12-13 in that second round. I don't know if it's going to happen in this region, but those are two teams who, if again, man, it's 18 to 22-year-olds playing a 40-minute basketball game, and anything can happen. But very interesting region here in the middle parts.
Yeah, again, the big names, Kentucky and Duke, will get a lot of attention because, like they always do. And both high upside teams. Kentucky, on the right night, they are impossible to beat. On the wrong night, they're easy to beat them. So Kentucky's a team that's like, I don't know about you, I feel like they have like maybe the widest range of any team in the country. Like if they play their best, they might be the best team in the country. And if they don't play their best, they're pretty easily beatable. So that's an interesting team to evaluate always.
Yeah, I would agree. Alabama, I mean, if you get them on a night
on
where they're hitting a bunch of threes, I mean, there's just
but
nothing.
Their defense stinks this year. That's the thing. Like
yeah.
in previous years when Alabama was, you're right though about the style they play, because they're very high paced, a lot of threes, a lot of high scoring. This year though, their defense actually stinks. Like it's not just about points per game. Like they're like, I'm looking at it now because I have to find the actual number because I'm obsessed. But Alabama's defense is actually, they're 112th in the country in defense. Like that's not good. In fact, Alabama and Kentucky are the only two teams in the top 40 in KenPom overall who are outside the top 100 in defense. Alabama and Kentucky. There you go.
Yeah. And historically, there's that great metric about having a top 20 offense and defense. I think something like 15 of the last 16 national title winners were top 20 in offensive and defensive efficiency. I think UConn in 2014 was the only team that kind of blew that out, or maybe 2011. So historically, you have definitely needed defense in order to win six games. But I agree completely that if either of those teams hit their ceiling and they're just firing on all cylinders, that they're kind of, I mean, they're not kind of, they're very dangerous with the firepower that they have.
That's right. All right. Last region here is the Midwest. This is the Purdue number one seed region. Purdue pretty infamously has not made the Final Four under Matt Painter. They lost last year in the first round in shocking fashion as the number one seed. They lost in the Sweet 16 the previous year. Zach Edey is the best player in the sport, but is a 7'4 center who needs some help getting himself the ball, let's just say. That's a story in itself. Then they have Tennessee, who's really good. Creighton. Kansas is fascinating to me because they have two like very, very, very major injuries. We don't know as we record this podcast if those guys are going to play. Gonzaga's in this region. McNeese State is like a fantastically interesting former LSU coach Will Wade's their coach. They've won 30 games this year. This one is actually really interesting to me because Purdue, I honestly, I'm kind of feeling like Purdue should win this region, but maybe it's me being a contrarian, and that sounds funny to be contrarian on number one seed, but I feel like everyone's like, it's Purdue. They're going to lose for sure.
Yeah. You know, I think a pretty favorable draw for Purdue. I know
so
some
too.
People, I know there was, I heard, I don't know who was saying it, a big time talking head was saying the committee just gave Purdue like a cakewalk after last year.
I don't know about that.
I don't think it's that. You took the words out of my mouth on Kansas. I mean, if they have McCullough and Dickinson back, that's a really good team, and I'm not one to bet against Bill Self, but I don't know how you can possibly know how healthy they are. You know, this is not your older brother's Gonzaga team. They're probably overseeded a little bit, but they still have a, you know, components of a team that's really good. I really like Creighton. I actually have Creighton winning this region. They have maybe the best trio of any team in college basketball this year. They were in the Elite Eight a year ago. They kind of do everything well. They had a really nice season with a bunch of big wins. So I think I ultimately think it's Purdue and Creighton. I also think Tennessee is really a good team, although Rick Barnes scares the hell out of me in March with his history. So overall, I mean, I could truly see either Purdue, Tennessee, or Creighton getting out of this region, and I really wouldn't put up too much of a surprise.
Yeah, no, I think this is honestly, all the regions are fairly open. This is not, I mean, there's been three teams this year that have been the best three teams on paper. It's been Houston, UConn, and Purdue in some order. So they are conceding, they're decent sized favorites in their regions, but I think only UConn is in the betting market like an actual coin flip. Everybody else is still like plus money ish to get out of their region, even though they're number one seed. So it's not a situation where there's like a single dominant team. You know, UConn from last year became a dominant team. It's still a really good UConn team, but they're not a team that I would say is like, you know, a lock to be a Final Four team. Like nobody's quite on that level for me this year.
Yeah, I would agree. I think for my money, the West and the Midwest are pretty significant steps down in terms of 1 through 16 from the East and the South.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, I mean, I think there's talent here, and I do agree that Kansas is kind of the wild card. I do like Oregon to beat South Carolina. Oregon is a dangerous team. They've had
the last bastion of the Pac-12.
Yes,
it's time, baby.
Pour one out for the ghost of the Pac-12. But Oregon's a dangerous team. They have a tremendous center in Enfali Dante, who nobody has heard of. Very good player. They have some great guards as well. They were a team that I think was preseason top 25, had a bunch of injuries and inconsistencies, but now they've gotten hot and they have a great coach in Dana Altman as well. So I guess if I was looking for a double digit seed in this region to win a game or maybe two, probably Oregon, although McNeese State with Will Wade is a great story as well.
Yeah, the reigning and final Pac-12 champion, Oregon Ducks, yeah, in the field. So there's that. Okay, Scott, you know it was coming. I need your Final Four and a winner before we get out of here.
Oh, man. So being chalky is always funny to me because everyone goes, oh, that's boring. But if you're trying to pick a bracket that's halfway decent, I think you kind of have to go chalk. I don't know. How do you feel about the chalk versus contrarian take, Brad?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I'm with you. I think that it's two different things. It's like, okay, we're going to have a prediction for fun. Or you're trying to, like, if you're trying to win a giant pool, if that's what your goal is, like, I'm in a pool with like 1,000 people in it. And like, if you just pick the top seeds, like, you're not going to win. Like, there's just no way. Unless they all get there, which I guess could happen. But yeah, if I was like going on TV to pick my bracket, I'd be pretty chalky. Cause like, it's just kind of smart to be chalky. Like, maybe you'll get made fun of, but it's less likely to be embarrassing if you're chalky.
Right.
Like in a pool, there's no way that I'm going to pick four top two seeds to make the Final Four in that pool. I'm not going to do that. Yeah, I'm going to take somebody crazy. But on this podcast, I'll probably be more chalky.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, what it is.
Well, I'll go for my bracket of record, which is sure to finish like 9 millionth place on ESPN. I like UConn to beat Iowa State in the East, although I do think there's some real hurdles there for as good as UConn is. I'll be a homer. I'll take Arizona in the West. I think it's about as favorable of a draw for Arizona as possible. Team that starts four seniors and has just a ton of experience. I'll take Arizona to break through. I'm going to go Houston. I really like Houston like you do. I know people find them boring and maybe overrated, but they just ran through the Big 12 this year. And then in a mild upset, I'm going to take Creighton to come out of the Midwest. I really could see a couple of teams out of that region emerging, but I'll take Creighton. They've been there before and really just have as good of a starting lineup as there is in college basketball. So I will say UConn, Arizona, Houston, and Creighton.
And your champion is Arizona, I presume, because it has to be.
No, I'm not that big of a homer. I'm going to go UConn and Houston. I'm actually going to take Houston to win it all.
Oh, no. That's what I was going to do. What's wrong with you?
Oh, man. Okay, I'll switch to UConn.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
I thought the whole world was going to have UConn. You just talked about how to win. I get the feeling that the whole world is going to have UConn. So maybe Houston is like the mathematical play in order to win a bracket with a lot of people. But if I had, I mean, either of those, I could see. I mean, I say this like last year, it wasn't a 4-5 seed in the national championship. Anything can happen, but
that's right.
Damn it. I was hoping we wouldn't be aligned.
No, that's okay. I mean, we're not always there at the end, but yeah, I am going to take Houston with the championship, but I would have had Houston the last 6 months. So they've been my team the whole way. So that's why I'm doing that. My Final Four on the record on this podcast is going to be Houston. I'm taking Purdue, the contrarian number one seed, which is, again, kind of crazy to say out loud, but I feel like that's actually going to be the case.
They are a better team this year than last.
Their guard play is way better this year. Not even close. Houston, Purdue are my number one seeds to make it. I'm going to take St. Mary's out of the West. My apologies to you and your Arizona Wildcats. I'm taking St. Mary's. I'm in on them for whatever reason. Am I taking Iowa State or Auburn? I'm not taking UConn. I'm not doing it. Give me the Auburn Tigers.
Yeah.
Little Southeast flavor. They are way underseeded. KenPom has them a fourth in the country and they're a four seed. That's actually what happened to UConn last year. As you mentioned before, UConn was a four seed last year, but I think they were like number five in the country in KenPom to begin the tournament. That's Auburn this year. I'm not saying they're the same team because they're not. Yeah. But Auburn is the team that probably has a one seed computer resume and they just don't have a one seed, like, you know, body of work.
Yeah.
But I really like them. They're good.
They're one of the few rosters who can go toe to toe with UConn for 40 minutes.
They sure can.
Is brutal for you. I mean, I know UConn's won like five titles in 20 some odd years, so I don't feel terrible for their fans. But that is a tough potential Sweet 16 matchup for a team that, by all accounts, was, you know, top two all year long.
And then maybe Iowa State. And Iowa State is really good. I believe they're number one or two in defense right now, along with Houston. And at KenPom, they just bludgeoned Houston in the Big 12 tournament. That's a very, very good team, and they're in that region too. So that's why I think just to be that guy, I'm going to fade UConn, even if I don't really believe it. I think they're actually really good still, but I'll just take somebody else to be fun. So yeah, that's where we are. And then the official prediction of Battery Power is the Houston Cougars winning the championship. So hopefully we'll be right every once in a while.
There we go. I think in some ways Houston is like the safest team in the field this year.
Well, that's certainly a curse that you just gave them, but thank you for
that. I'm sorry. Yeah, I know.
No, it's fine.
No one listen to this podcast. but like just their style is conducive to safer, right? Like they're not a team that relies on 23 pointers going in or having refs who are really, you know, ticky-tack or not ticky-tack with their calls. I mean, I think they have
Defense travels, as they say, Scott.
High floor, maybe not the highest ceiling, but I do think they have the highest floor.
Yeah, and I look at their body of work right now. They only have four losses this year. All four losses are to really good teams. They lost to Iowa State twice, on the road on one of those, and the neutral site on the other one. They lost to TCU by 1 point on the road. That's a tournament team. And they lost to Kansas on the road, and people lose to Kansas on the road. That's what happens. So, yeah. Like, they have bad losses.
Yeah, healthy Kansas on the road.
Yeah, healthy Kansas on the road in Fog Allen. Like, what are you supposed to do with that? So, no bad losses. Defense is incredible. Very well coached. They have veteran guards. Like, they're all the stuff that I like. Houston has it all. And I'm sure one of these games, they're going to shoot 2 for 17 from three and lose. But that's fine.
Of course. Yeah, that's they do have that risk being limited offensively. Brad, do you have any double-digit seeds in the Sweet 16?
Ooh, let me pull it up real fast. There was one. My, oh, go ahead.
I have. I'll give you 2 seconds. I have New Mexico, which I talked about earlier. I think they're hot. I think they have a bunch of guards who can win in March, and they are underseeded significantly. I think New Mexico, and I don't have it in my official bracket yet, but I kind of think either McNeese or Samford is going to come out of that Gonzaga, Kansas little quadrant. I don't know. It screams weirdness to me of naturally it'll be chalky and both the favorites will win by like 15 points. But I might put McNeese State in the Sweet 16 just for that classic 12 seed winning two games.
Yeah, I really wish Grand Canyon wasn't playing St. Mary's because I'm like, I love St. Mary's, but Grand Canyon could beat Alabama in the second round. So if they beat St. Mary, that's one that I would circle. I'm mad that Drake's where they are because I like Drake, but they're playing Iowa State and I don't love that matchup for them. I think, I want to give you one more that could do it. I will say,
James Madison has a real chance.
They're interesting for sure. I would say the winner of Boise and Colorado could do it. I think that both of those teams are different, but they're both pretty potent. Colorado's very talented, bunch of NBA players. Boise State's really well coached. Florida's banged up. That's their first round opponent they get in the tournament, of course. It's 7 seed. And then I don't love Marquette. With the Kolick injury, they have some roster challenges. Like, I think that the winner of Boise and Colorado as a 10 seed could get there too. So
I like it. Yeah.
There you go. And also, McNeese is, man, same thing as Grand Canyon. I was actually looking forward to taking McNeese or Grand Canyon, and they're both playing teams that I don't want them to play. I think Gonzaga's, they kind of peaked late. They're pretty good again. St. Mary's too. I wish they were playing somebody else. In fact, I wish McNeese was playing Kansas instead of Sanford. Because if McNeese was playing Kansas, I pick McNeese.
McNeese or are they McNeese State?
I think they might have changed that in recent years. So I feel like they were always McNeese State, but then they were like on the official bracket, it says McNeese.
I just saw that too. So if you're a McNeese, you're a McNeese/McNeese State alum, please let me know. I like your team and I like your program. So I just was looking at that anyway.
I should go full heel, Scott, and be like, all right, Virginia, Sweet 16.
Everybody hates Virginia. I'm sure we have Virginia listeners. They might even agree with me that they did not deserve to be in the tournament this year.
I agree with you on that. Number one, I will say they shouldn't be there. Number two, they could beat Colorado State and then beat Texas. I would not be surprised at all if that happened.
Yeah.
Now, they would lose to Tennessee, I think. But Virginia, it's not like they're playing a team that's going to like blow them out. Like, I think they'll be like if they beat Colorado State on Wednesday, which isn't a lock by any means, or Tuesday, whatever that game is, they'll be like a 3-point underdog against Texas. Like, they could win those games. They're not terrible. It's just that they play really, 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 really unsightly basketball. Like, it's not fun to watch. Like, when they were really good a few years ago, they got that label of being hard to watch because they played so slow. But they actually were pretty good on offense back then. They just played slow. Now they are absolutely awful on offense. Like, they are awful. Truly. Like,
yeah.
They can't score. They can't score, Scott. It's brutal.
Hasn't there been a play-in game team into the Sweet 16 in like 7 of the 8 years or something?
Yeah, that's something like that. I wish I had a stat in front of me. But yeah, there's been a bunch of them in recent years, even making longer runs than that. Like, there's been teams that have gone to the Elite Eight out of Dayton. So yeah, there's a team that does it this year. I think it's not impossible at all. I think all four of the 10 seeds that are in Dayton, Boise, Colorado State, Virginia, and Colorado, are all like pretty decent. Like, that's not a bad crop of teams. Like, Virginia shouldn't be there, like we just agreed on, but if provided that they are there, they could definitely win some games. Colorado's got tons of talent. Cody Williams is probably top 10 pick in the draft, et cetera. And the two Mountain West teams are really good. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if they made a run at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
there you go.
It'll be fun. I wish we could talk about that. I mean, we probably could ramble for like another hour on the bracket, but.
Oh no, I did the fast version, Scott. I have, you can't imagine how much writing I have to do between, let's just say yesterday and tip off on Thursday. It is, I am buried under 10 feet of paper right now. It's really bad. I'm really tired. The Hawks play at 10:30 tonight as we're recording this podcast. I'll be in bed about 3. It's going to be awesome. I'm feeling great right now, Scott. I feel really
that
fresh.
Time of year. Who needs sleep? You don't even go to bed. You know, just put a cup of coffee on.
I might have to do that tonight going into work tomorrow on Tuesday morning. I have to get up for work at 6. I'll be in bed at 3. It's better off. I guess I probably should sleep for 3 hours, but whew, close call. Okay, Scott, let's end the podcast. We could throw a curveball and talk about some baseball at the end of the show, make everybody mad at us that we told them to log off.
But breaking news. That would be, gosh, do a 2-hour podcast on a Monday night.
Let's get out of here, Scott. Where can people find all of your fantastic work? Because I'm sure you'll be live tweeting Arizona basketball pretty soon.
I actually try not to do that because whenever
this weekend when Arizona lost, I was looking at your tweet. I was like, Scott's not even tweeting about Arizona. What's going on right now? They're losing. What's going on? Why aren't you tweeting about this?
I usually get a fair number of replies from people just completely confused of what I'm talking about. So I try not to do that. I'm at Scott Coleman 55. Be sure to check out the site this week. There's all kinds of preview content for the Braves and for the NL East and the upcoming season. As we said, we are just over a week away from opening day. I think the Braves actually wrap up spring training a week from now, which is exciting. Then they head north to Philadelphia and then go play the White Sox. So baseball is right around the corner. A lot of good content coming on the website and on this podcast network. And Brad and I will be back soon for our annual predictions podcast, which is always a good time.
Yep, that is coming soon. We'll also have content from Sean and Chris and Steven in between that. So please subscribe, like Scott said, tell a friend about the podcast. And we'll see you all next time.